The Good GP podcast is excited to have MedTech Global as a sponsor. MedTech is on a mission to digitally transform general practice so GPs can focus on quality patient care. For more information about MedTech Global, visit medtechglobal.com.
You're listening to The Good GP, the podcast for busy GPs.
Hello and welcome to The Good GP. My name's Sean Stevens, and before we start The Good GP, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners on the lands upon which this podcast is recorded. This episode is brought to you from the lands of the Kulin and Noongar Nations. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Leaping straight into it, my guest today is Sarah Heineman. Sarah is a Melbourne-based early career medical oncologist and PhD candidate with Sydney Health Ethics, exploring ethical and epistemic implications of novel and emerging trends across cancer clinical trial landscapes. She's a long-standing research interest in cancer survivorship, particularly how the concept applies to the metastatic disease setting, and facilitates the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre's Cancer Survivorship for Primary Care Practitioners online course. She's an early career representative on the Thoracic Oncology Group of Australasia and involved in medical student education at Monash University. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for the invitation.
So, there's been some major advances in cancer therapies across a number of types of cancer. Can you please give me some examples that GPs may be seeing where patients may previously have not survived and where their care needs have changed?
Yeah, thanks, Sean, for the question. I guess it's a really exciting time to be working in oncology and interacting with patients with cancer from a variety of different perspectives. And I think that includes both those of us within the hospital-based setting as well as those health practitioners in the community, such as your listeners. And really, the last sort of 10, 20 years with increasing move away from traditional chemotherapy-based treatments with the advent of new treatments such as immunotherapy and targeted therapies and a variety of others has seen marked improvements both in prognosis for a number of different patient groups as well as in quality of life in terms of side effect and toxicity management of our treatments as well. And that's really, I guess, prompted a broadening of the definition of who we might consider to be a traditional cancer survivor, if you like. And I think traditionally, when people hear the term cancer survivor, they think about someone who has had treatment for an early stage cancer, had curative intent treatment, and then the survivorship phase is the period after that treatment. However, the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship thinks of a cancer survivor as much broader than that. So it really applies to anyone from the time of cancer diagnosis through the balance of their life. And it also includes not just patients, but also people surrounding patients such as carers and friends as well. And I guess particularly in the last sort of 10 years or so, different treatments such as immunotherapy and targeted therapy have had a particular impact on certain cancer types, which we'd consider as historically poor or dismal prognoses. For example, metastatic melanoma or metastatic non-small cell lung cancer that have really benefited from these sorts of treatments, and patients are living much, much longer with those cancer types. So just as one example, patients who are diagnosed with metastatic or advanced non-small cell lung cancer who have certain genetic mutations, which means that they can access targeted therapies, often, you know, be afforded a much longer prognosis. For example, the median overall survival for patients diagnosed with a particular type of non-small cell lung cancer with a mutation in the EGFR gene, if they receive the standard first-line treatment, their median overall survival is 38 or so months. And that's quite different to treatments that we would have been giving patients 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, no, interesting. It's such a fascinating area. And, you know, I've got, like we were talking about before we started, you know, I've got tens of patients with cancer and I've seen a difference. But working at the cutting edge, you'd be seeing a lot of this happening. So when things are going well, so say the tumour's not growing on a scan, for example, what supportive care should GPs be looking at? And how can we get an idea of the prognosis from the treating oncologist?
Yeah, so it's good to be able to talk about, I guess, this subset of patients who are fortunate enough, you know, to experience prolonged periods of disease stability whereby they're continuing to receive treatment, but the cancer doesn't appear to be growing on a scan. And often these patients feel in the oncology clinic are easy, if you like, patients to see because things can be very quick. Great, your scan looks good. Okay, we'll see you in a couple of months' time. But that often fails to dig below the surface of any of the other, I guess, needs that they might have during that time. So whilst things may be going well as far as a cancer growth perspective, they may have a range of other what we deem supportive care or survivorship concerns. And I guess there's a range of different issues that patients might experience, both in terms of potential toxicities of the treatment. So for example, that situation I referred to for patients with non-small cell lung cancer, if they're on a targeted therapy, often those therapies are very well tolerated, certainly in comparison to chemotherapy, but it might be a tablet every day rather than chemotherapy once every couple of weeks in cycles. So having continuous treatment comes with other potential issues. Some of the earlier medications were associated with skin toxicities such as acneiform rashes, which may have required topical treatments. Some of the medications associated with gastrointestinal upset, for example, diarrhea, and that can be quite interrupting for someone's quality of life if that's an ongoing experience. But it's also something that can easily be addressed if the patient's asked about that either by the medical oncology team or the GP. So that's in terms of physical potential side effects of medications. But I guess there's also a range of other psychological side effects or unmet needs that patients in this circumstance might have. In many respects, patients in this situation often find themselves with a foot in both worlds experience. On the one hand, they have what's probably ultimately an incurable cancer, but if they've got a prolonged prognosis with newer treatments, there's often a lot of challenges around uncertainty about the future, both in terms of prognosis, what do I do about work, what do I do about superannuation, concern or anxiety around scans, or scan anxiety is a pretty common symptom or concern for patients. So it may well be that patients in these circumstances would benefit from extra psychological support as well. And I guess there's often a lot of informational needs that these patients have as well about the types of treatment that they're on, some of which can be provided by, I guess, the medical team in the hospital, and others of which will require referral to allied health, whether in the hospital or beyond the hospital. And I guess overarching all of this, often individuals' experiences can be quite different as well. So there's a real need, as in oncology, we're increasingly individualizing treatment. I think in the supportive care domains as well, there's an increased importance of being able to tailor supportive care treatments to individuals as well. However, I think what often happens is these patients in the oncology setting often are seen infrequently because they're doing well from a cancer perspective. And we may think that some of these concerns are being dealt with in the community setting. But on the other hand, if in the community setting, people assume that these sorts of concerns are being dealt with in the hospital setting, sometimes these patients can fall between the cracks. I guess the other sort of aspect as well is improved prognosis. It's increasingly relevant that the other comorbidities of patients get managed as well, which is something that I guess in the community-based setting, GPs are the experts at managing as well. So just one tiny example. So in non-small cell lung cancer, patients who have a particular type of genetic alteration in the ALK gene may go on a medication called lorlatinib, which is associated with great opportunity for longevity as far as treatment. But one of the common side effects of that can be impacts on the cholesterol. And so often those patients need quite aggressive management of lipids and cholesterol. Whereas I guess in the past, if your perception of a patient with advanced lung cancer was that their prognosis was going to be short, so why on earth would we worry about the cholesterol or the lipids, you may not, I guess, recognise the relevance of managing those sorts of comorbidities in these newer group of patients.
Interesting. And then there's, of course, the family that you mentioned previously. And so that's really interesting as a GP, the importance of that follow-up between oncology clinic appointments. It's really not to be underestimated and probably is of greater importance now than it used to be even a few years ago.
Absolutely.
So part of our role of GPs is the communication across multidisciplinary teams, and it's critical in cancer care and survivorship. Can you tell me who you think should be included in the team and how can we best communicate within that team?
Yeah, I guess that's a difficult question to give a snap answer to, because I think that will depend on the individual concerned. And as you alluded to, whether we're talking about the patient as a cancer survivor, if you like, or the patient's spouse as a cancer survivor, definitely there are going to be different needs between those different groups of people. And that in part will determine who's going to be the key players. I think both the GP and the medical oncology team in the hospital have a key part to play as far as care coordination, particularly because often patients with metastatic cancer experience more transitions between different care teams if they have different types of treatment, or in the hospital, for example, may engage with different subspecialists such as radiation oncologists in some instances or medical oncologists. I think a number of the survivorship concerns that probably the expertise of the broader allied health team as well. So for example, management of fatigue or weight gain might be something that an exercise physiologist could help out with, or management of anorexia might be something that a dietitian would be helpful with. Given what I've said earlier, I think clearly psychologists are linchpins of survivorship often. And sometimes that may be serviced within the hospital, someone who, a psychologist who has a particular interest in cancer care, or it might be, I might suggest that they speak to their GP and engage in a mental health plan and access psychology in the community. Unfortunately, often that's a resourcing issue as well. So those might be just some of the different players. I think that, I guess, the central person within all of that should be the patient themselves. And I think probably one thing I think we need to do as health practitioners is to be empowering patients to be able to bring up these sorts of concerns as well, even if we don't think to ask about them, that they can recognise that it's valid for them to bring up the anxiety that they have before a scan, or it's valid for them to bring up the issues that they have managing diarrhea, for example, as a consequence of their treatment. And I think part of that is by healthcare teams, both in the community and in the hospital, being proactive, checking with patients, are you really okay? I think another aspect of that is probably both the patient, but also the healthcare teams in the hospital, as well as in the community, having, as far as possible, a good understanding of the patient's prognosis as well. And I think if that's not something that's clear, that's something that can be asked about either by the patient or the GP, because if someone's got a prognosis of 12 months versus many years, for example, in the case of hormone-positive breast cancer, definitely that's has different implications in terms of management as well as in managing the patient's psychological state as well. But that may or may not always be evident. Sometimes I feel like patients have a, you know, unrealistic expectations about prognosis in both a positive sense, in the sense that they may feel that their prognosis is a lot longer than I would expect. But it's just as devastating if patients have a very unrealistic negative expectation of prognosis, and actually their prognosis is much better.
Yeah, interesting. It's a rapidly changing world, isn't it? And finally, Sarah, are there any cancer therapies coming in the next few years that you think GPs should be aware of?
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's a difficult one to answer almost, because it's certainly an exciting time, I think, to be involved in cancer care, because there's been a lot of developments in recent years. I guess in the past decade, the most notable of those have been the advent of targeted therapies and immunotherapies that we're using, particularly in some tumour types, more so than chemotherapy nowadays. Having said that, we still use chemotherapy as well. And I guess one of the things that we've seen recently is novel ways to use immunotherapy, so more targeted ways to deliver chemotherapy, such as antibody drug conjugates. I think, though, being aware of the different range of toxicities that targeted therapies have, which are often tablet-based treatments that patients will take on a daily basis, as well as immunotherapy-based treatments and the range of immunotherapy-related toxicities, is key, because these differ from standard chemo-based toxicities that we normally think about, such as febrile neutropenia. And because patients are often taking these for longer periods of time as well, they may well be the GP that they come across in terms of reporting challenges such as diarrhea or skin toxicity such as rashes. Often these side effects as well might be low or moderate grade, so maybe they don't meet the radar of discussing at the oncologist appointment, but still certainly have an impact on quality of life for patients. I guess the other sort of more broader aspect of that would be being able to be involved in clinical trials, which is something we certainly look at for all of our patients, and being aware of the implications of being on clinical trials for patients, such as the time toxicity associated with that. And then I guess another thing to be aware of as well is the increasing ubiquitous role that genomics testing has on being able to characterise cancers as well as open up different treatment options. And I think GPs can play a role as well in helping contextualise and the reason for that for patients, particularly the difference between, for example, germline and somatic mutations, where germline mutations can have implications for family, whereas somatic mutations don't. So it's always nice to be able to reassure patients that have misconstrued that, particularly I guess in the primary care context, where the GP might also be looking after other members of the family as well. But in general, I think it's a rapidly moving space. We're making improvements both in terms of prognosis as well as quality of life in terms of side effect management, as well as different permutations of both old tools of the trade, such as chemotherapy, plus adding in newer treatments such as immunotherapies and targeted therapies, and working out the best sequencing of that as well as different combinations.
Yeah, look, it's fascinating. Like you say, a very rapidly evolving space. And Sarah, you mentioned there's a couple of resources that you're going to send to our listeners that can be put on the website for the episode.
Yeah, so a couple of things that would be good for your listeners to be aware of. So the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre actually runs an online survivorship course for primary care practitioners a couple of times a year, which I facilitate, which both GPs, allied health clinicians and consumers can complete at their own time, and that's a good resource. A second resource which could be helpful both for GPs as well as patients is the Australian Cancer Survivorship Centre, based out of Petermack, has a great website with lots of different bits of information about different survivorship concerns. And the other thing I'll send you as well is our article that we recently published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, looking at setting the research agenda for survivorship for patients living with metastatic cancer.
That's brilliant. Look, thank you, Sarah. I look forward to receiving those. And, you know, I really wish you all the best for your research and for your work. And thanks very much for being a guest on The Good GP.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Good GP podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. Make sure you're subscribed on your favourite podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you have any questions or would like to contact The Good GP, send an email to thegoodgp@gmail.com. The content of this podcast represents the opinions of The Good GP, hosts and guests of the show. The content is aimed at general practitioners working in the Australian context and is not intended to represent medical advice. Any listeners experiencing symptoms or who have concerns about their health should seek advice from a registered health professional. We make every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate and up to date at the time of recording, but welcome any feedback or corrections. The content of this podcast is general in nature and does not refer to specific patient management. We recommend all health professionals review local and up-to-date guidelines prior to any clinical decisions.